February 2nd, 1976. Sends me a clipping from the Pacific edition of the Stars and Stripes, an authorized unofficial publication, the U.S. Armed Forces of the Pacific Command. And here's a little quote. This is just a little clip here. It's from Antofagasta. It's a great name for a town, isn't it? Antofagasta. Antofagasta. Sounds like a new secret ingredient. Antofagasta. Antofagasta chili. Pepito, a small monkey from Central America, was the neighborhood's mascot. Pepito, until a terrible moment. He stole and ate a sandwich spiced with hot chili pepper. Pepito, oh, Pepito. He went berserk, bit one person, nearly destroyed the contents of his master's house, and terrorized the entire neighborhood. The monkey's master, Claudio Reynoso, said the police arrested Pepito. They put the arm on the Pepito and sent him to the local zoo. And now Pepito is sitting there in the cage drinking a lot of water. And, and he's having himself a... I mean, now, wait a minute. Don't laugh. Now, listen, you guys laugh at this, and maybe you don't know what he is... what he's going through, what he is suffering, Pepito. He ate a sandwich with chili in it. Now, just a minute. Now, I know exactly what he's talking about. Do any of you people... the thing about you people who live here in the East, you don't really know much about the variegated ethnic quality of the world in which you live. You're laughing at the pizza, because most of you, the most spicy thing you have is a little granola in the morning. You don't know about the pizza. You know, one of the great things about living in an industrial area of the country is that there's like 12 and a half million types of nationalities always in any industrial area. I've always felt sorry for a kid, who grows up in Darien. Boy, that must be an exciting, rich life. I was growing up on the south side of Chicago. Stand on the south side of Chicago. The term melting pot had no meaning at all, because everybody I knew was like a different nationality. But there was all of them as nationalities. They were just, Paulus, Geza, Schwartz, and they were all just various kids. Nobody thought anything, Paulus was Polish, okay? So he's Polish. The only time you thought of him being Polish was when you went to his house. And his mother spoke hardly any English at all, and always wore the shawl over her head. See? And I learned enough Polish to ask loudly, "Where's Bolek?" In Polish, it's pronounced Bolek. I say, something, "Where's Bolek?" In Polish, and she says, Bolek. I say, okay, I'll be back. I'll come back later. Well, then I would go over to Geza's house, Geza Niemet. Now, what nationality is that? Geza Niemet. Ah, Geza. Geza Niemet? Hungarian. Ain't him, toot him, dashik, the bolomajo. And so I would talk a little Hungarian when I go over to see Geza, and I'd talk a little Swedish when I go over to see Anderson. Yeah, they always had this anise bread. Well, at that time, I had this paper out. And, there's all kinds of little gimmicks you pull on a paper out. And my paper out, I'd start out at 6 o'clock, maybe even earlier, 5:30 in the morning. I delivered the morning paper, the Chicago Tribune, and at night I would deliver the night paper. Yeah. See, it was the Chicago Sun-Times. I delivered the paper. No, it wasn't Sun-Times. It was the Herald American. That's right. I would deliver the Herald American, which was an afternoon paper. So I had two routes and different customers. Some guys got the morning paper and didn't get the afternoon paper. Other guys got the afternoon paper and didn't get the morning. Some guys got both of them, you know. And so every day I would go over to the place where we'd get our papers. Now, I'm telling you this for a reason, because I understand Pepito's problem. There's a thing happening one time that had to do with Pepito, which I will never forget. And my paper route was a kind of a variegated type paper route. It was a paper route that didn't just have a lot of houses in it, like I would deliver the paper, say, for example, at a Shell station. The guy would get the paper. I also delivered the paper to a grocery store. I'd drive, you know, my bike, and I would ride past, and they had a bread box or something out in the front. I threw a paper in there. Well, every day I would deliver to a lot of houses and all kinds of things. And then at the end of the route, my route was a big sort of horseshoe-shaped route, or if you prefer, a route. But it was more of a route than a route. It was a route in many ways. I was often routed. I mean, it was, yeah, because, you know, you learn a lot about humanity when you're trying to collect on your paper route. You really do, you know. Every day, selflessly, you deliver the paper. And you come up Saturday to get the few miserable shekels that the guy looks at you and says, "What do you want?" This is a collector of paper. He says, "I don't want a paper." Bam, he slams the door. He's been getting a paper all week. All right, that's one type. I'm not here to tell you about collecting for the paper. I'm telling you what happened to me, so I understand Pepito. Pepito, the poor little monkey that ate the sandwich with the peppers in it. And why he went berserk. I know exactly why he went berserk. And so my route would start out, and it would start rather innocently. A row of houses. I'd throw the paper up on the porch. And then I would hit the Shell station. I'd throw the paper up on the Shell station there. And then I would go on down the street, and I'd go past the lumber yard. I could still see my route. I know I'd be stopping around. If, you know, I can always fall back on that. You guys think you're pushing me around. Oh, no, I can fall back on that business. I was a damn good paper boy. And I'd come to the lumber yard. And this guy in the lumber yard, he's always get the paper. So, but he says, "You got to throw it in over the fence, because if you don't throw it over the fence, somebody will steal it." So I'd love to hit the lumber yard. He had this big, high fence, see? And I used to go cooling past on my Elgin bike. I got really official. I got a Schwinn. Yes, I had Columbia chain tires on. It was a Schwinn. You ever own a Schwinn bike? Schwinn. And so I'm cooling along on my Schwinn bike. Now, the reason I liked this Schwinn bike, it had a gear shift out of it. You know? Had three speeds. You know? Oh, wow. So I'd throw it in a second. I'd go up the hill there, and then I would cool down the hill. And the lumber yard was at the bottom of the hill. It was always very exciting. See, and I would get this thing going real good, and then I would go coasting down this hill, the wind blowing at 5:30 in the morning, and the shot over the fence was a sidearm shot because he was away from my throwing arm. I'm a right-handed tosser, and this lumber yard would be on my left, and I'd come whistling down this hill right next to the curb. So I whistle down, and as I get next to the gravel driveway, I'd let this baby go. Sidearm, underhand, beautiful toss, up over the fence, you know, and I'd hear it bouncing down there on the porch of the office there, and then I'd go, I'd make the left-hand turn, and I would cut down to Arizona Street. It was always a dramatic moment at the base of that turn on the Schwinn. And then I would go past three more houses, I would turn right, and it was another grocery store. And I'm working my way through this paper route. You know, and after you had done this thing for like a year, you knew it just absolutely cold, man. And you could tell when they changed the flower pot on the porch. You know, you get to know every house, and you know, and you knew every dog intimately, every dog. About one-third of the way into my route, right after I would pass the lumber yard, and I would go past these three houses, and I would go past a Standard Oil of Indiana station. They also got it down there. I would go down past the grocery store, and I would make a right. There was a great big gabled house with these people named Swisher, C.B. Swisher. Phoebe Swisher had this great big yellowish kind of house, see, and it was set back. Had a lawn, had a big big hedge all around it, and it had one of these little gates, you know, in the hedge there, with this little wire type gate with a little iron pipe and all that stuff. And I used to wait for this one, because as I would approach, I would see a rustling in the bushes. And I'd see the bushes wiggle, see, and that mother used to wait for me. It was an Airedale. Now they don't have Airedales anymore. This is a dog which is now extinct. There are no Airedales. You notice that? And rightly so. Mean. And they have big square jaws, and they have eyes that look like they're made out of marble. And wiry hair. You could actually remove paint with the hide of an Airedale. It's wiry hair. See. And so, big, tall, knobby knees. They're great big knees. His knees look like marbles. You know, great big knees. And he had the real skinny, but tall, and scruffy looking. You know, it's like chunks of his hair were formed. This is the way Airedales look. Like, you know, they always look like you either should throw a lot of chlorine over them, or Clorox, or something. You know, they're scruffy. You know, you've seen them. So I would come cooling around down there. It's every morning. It's about 6:15. And I'm making the big turn. I'm halfway through. This marks the halfway point of my route. And from here on in, it was homeward bound, see, back to the barn, you know. So I'm making the turn, and every morning this thing would be, I see the weeds. Then I see the hedges rustling, see. And he would run along the hedge inside, so I couldn't see him, see. And I'd see the hedges waving a little bit. I could tell what he was by what was wiggling, see. And sure enough, just as I'm about to throw this thing, he would wait, see. He knew. My most vulnerable moment, any paper boy's most vulnerable moment, is when he is arm extended about to throw. You agree? After the throw, you can defend yourself. Before the throw, you can defend yourself. But when you're starting to swing, the underarm swing with the paper, you are absolutely at the mercy of anything. Well, he used to wait. I'd see those two little eyeballs looking at him. Looking out of the hedge, and sure enough, I tried to trick him, you know. I tried to trick him by throwing over my head real quick like that, and trying an underhanded shot, you know. But he would see my arm move. So he would come, all of a sudden, he'd come bursting out, and he would just, you know, that kind of frantic yell. And I start pumping like mad. Man, I bet say about 3 times out of 5. He would get my right ankle. You know, it's just like old war wounds. You know, you hear about these guys with the old Civil War wounds. Well, some mornings, you know, when I come in here, I walk around, especially when it's rainy and cold out, my old paperboy wounds come back. And I could feel my right ankle start to ache. Well, that crummy, rotten Airedale. You're interested in what his name was? Why should I tell you what his name was? Scruffy. And he was Scruffy. I mean, it sounds cute, doesn't it? He was about as cute as an impacted wisdom tooth, you know? And he used to come out and grab my right ankle. He always grabbed the ankle and it hurt, you know? At that point, I had cuts and bruises, and one time he tore a tennis shoe off, and he just grabbed the ankle every time. Well, then, of course, this is what sets man apart from the beasts. Which reminds me, this is WOR, New York. Now, wait a minute. Now, it was man that reminded me of WOR, not beasts. Well, you know, you want to hear more about the Pete, and the Scruffy. Oh, Scruffy, yeah. Well, man is an infinitely adaptable creature, and the one thing that sets man apart from the other creatures is that he can vary his M.O. What is it, the M.O.? You've seen enough bad cop shows on TV to know what an M.O., isn't it? Modus operandi. Or method of operation, for those of you out in Staten Island. But, that's the way it do something. Huh? Okay, that's better. And now, of course, many a cop will tell you that the way they catch most thieves is, you know, some guy that's a criminal type is because they tend to do it the same way, you know. So if every time you pull your job, you know, you lose a ballpoint fountain pen at the place with your name on it, that becomes your M.O. And it's not before long, they'll throw the net over you. You know, they'll catch you. Aha! The ballpoint burglar has struck again. Well, all right, that's an M.O. But the thing about man is that he can vary his M.O., whereas the lion does not. No, the lion kills the same way every time. He does not say, this time I'm going to mug him. No, he may do pretty good, you know, getting a zebra if he says to his fellow lion, hey, Simba.
Yeah, what do you want, Leo? Simba? Look, I'm getting tired of chasing zebras. What I'm going to do is dig a hole and cover it up with some weeds. And the zebra's going to come and fall in the hole. How do you like that? I'll trap him.
Well, that would be one hell of a lion, wouldn't it? But he can't do this, see? He does not vary his M.O. And he just continues to bat his head out against the zebras and, doing the best he can. But man is different. So after about 2 or 3 weeks, I realized that Scruffy had an M.O. Now, what his M.O. was, he would wait. He knew. He sensed. Have you noticed dogs can sense when somebody's coming for blocks away? And he would sense I'm coming, see? So, they know the time, everything, dogs. But the trouble with them is they still have an inflexibility. So he would hide in the corner of the hedge. And then when he would hear my Schwinn bike approach in second gear, he would start running along the hedge parallel to my path, see? And then just before I got to the gate, he knew at that point, I would throw sidearm, just zap sidearm, right? That was a right-hand shot. Sidearm like that, underhand sidearm shot, up on the porch of the house, which was right opposite the gate, you see. Okay, at that point, he knew that just before I came to the gate, my arm was ready to go, and I'd start to throw, and he would come popping out of the weeds. He'd come right through that hedge. Bam! And the next thing I know, I've got this 400-pound monster hanging on my ankle again, right? Okay. Always the same. He did the same thing. Well, now, that was a simple thing, see, when you're dealing with one of the lesser beasts. This is how I get along with the sales department over here. You learn these tricks. When you're dealing with the lesser beast, you know that this simplest little change in the routine confuses them. Totally confuses them. Takes them months to figure out the new routine. So instead of waiting till I got to the gate to throw this thing, you know what I did? I just, halfway down the hedge, I would shoot a long sidearm, underarm swoop deflection shot. Whee! Go like that. And then at that point, I would turn quickly left and cut across the street, and he'd come, ha! And running out of the reach, nothing. You know, he's snapping away, and my ankle is 50 feet away. And he's yelling, his eyeballs are red, and of course, I'm very confused. Well, I did this about 3 or 4 days. And 3 or 4 days, he's confused. He keeps trying the same thing. Well, at the end of the 3rd or 4th day, it finally, soaked through that dim Airedale brain what I was doing. And he figured he's going to take it head on this time. So instead of waiting for me to throw, he caught me the first day, yes. This is where man varies from the dog, though, after the lesser beast of the field. He'll catch you the first day. Yeah, you may get eaten up by a lion the first time, but the second time you'll get him between the eyes, right? Well, you're 30-06, and that'll comprise him. So, nevertheless, I come whistling up to the switcher house. You know, I say, I'm going to get old Scubby. Wait till I get him this time again. See, instead, he comes popping out instantly. Ah! He goes, just about the time I read that, he's got me ready ankle again. Okay. I'll fix you. And then, at the point that I really begin to develop my true counter-offensive. Up to that point, I had always worn tennis shoes on the route, right? Well, were you involved? All kids all go through the work shoe scene, right? When you wear the big, heavy, ankle-high work shoes, the kind you get down at the Army Navy store, right? So I had a pair of work shoes, great big babies, the kind that are sort of orange-colored, yellow, with the thick rubber soles. Please, boy, they weigh 8 pounds apiece. And so I put on my work shoes. Covered my ankle, see? Not only that, I was ready for that little old varmint. When he came out,
He'd just go, rah! And he would always leap, see? He would just leap. He'd leave his front feet off the ground and make a grab at my ankle. Again, the M.O. caught it. I knew exactly the angle he would come out of the weeds at. Because he always went for my ankle. He did not go for my, shall we say, posterior. He did not go for my calf. He went for my ankle. Always the same ankle. So this day, he comes rolling out, and I am ready for him. Just as I see the weeds part, I take my right foot off of the pedal, and I catch him with a shot right on the chops, right in the middle of the leap. Wait a minute. It was a magnificent. It was just, have you ever seen Hank Aaron catch one on the fat side of the bat? You notice how effortless he makes it look? Timing. It's all timing, wrist action. It's timing, coordination, and wrist. No power much in that. You notice that? Just a pop like that. Out it goes. Yeah, Roger Maris is like this. Timing. Wrist action. It's all coordination. Well, that first day, I caught Scruffy on the right chop with my work shoe. He's in midair. I caught him just as he's leaping. And the combined weight of his leap and my shoe and the fact that I was rolling forward on the Schwinn about 20 miles an hour was fantastic. He just went, pow, like that. He turned over in midair, went backwards over the hedge, going, ah, 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 you know how it does, ah, ah, ah. He landed on the back of his head, went around the side of the house, and down into the cellar, screaming every inch of the way. Well, I don't have to tell you, from that day on, I looked forward to hitting the Swisher house. Because for at least 3 days, poor old Scruffy kept doing the same move, and I kept catching him on the same shot. Until today. All right, we're not going to bother you with this. You want to hear about Pepito. Yes, well, all right, this is the whole point. Now, I don't know whether many of you recognize when a person has a delivery route. Now, I don't know how many of you ever have delivered anything. But the delivery route itself becomes as familiar as the back of your hand. And you work out all kinds of little inner routines that don't have anything to do exactly with delivering. It's just shortcut here, shortcut there. And you see the same person in the same corner every morning, and you know when the geraniums have been changing. It gets to be very familiar with it. Well, at the end of my route, when I would come sweeping on back down around Kennedy Street, they had a big, you know, big street. This is a business street. It was the last shot on my route, and I was heading back for the barn, the headquarters, see, where I would turn in my sack and all that stuff. I'd come swishing down the street, and I would deliver to about 5 stores and about 18 taverns. Taverns. Bars to you. Joints. Right? And they had all kinds of great names. Yeah. You know, I could, you know, Al and Eddie's. You look every morning, Al and Eddie's. He's never open. Al and Eddie's always open in the afternoon scene. I would throw the paper up against the door and go on. But there was one place, the Bluebird, that was open every morning because these guys catered to the steel workers. Now, the Bluebird was a very special type of tavern. And every tavern around it was special in its own way, see? But I would come down, and I'd pass the pool room, I'd go past the hardware store, and then I would go past this laundrette and then the Bluebird. Now, the Bluebird was always open. The bartender would come in there every morning at about, it must have been about 7 o'clock. And he would just clean up the joint. He was not open for business until 8. But his door would be open, and he would be in there mopping up the bar. You know, he's got this mop, and he's working away there. And all the cases are piled up. They made the delivery of the beer and the ginger ale and junk for the day. And this great big bartender was always in there with this white, the big white apron on. He's cleaning up the joint. And I would come cooling past, and I would just sort of just drift in through the door. You know, when you're really good on your bike, you're really, you know, it's part of your body. You know, I make this turn in. And I would throw the paper back onto one of the tables. And almost every morning, he would say, hey, kid, I'd say, you want some popcorn? That's okay. And he used to have, on the bar, he had these little plastic bowls full of popcorn. And stuff like potato chips. And he'd have a little, and he'd be filling them in the morning because these guys would get off the shift. Steel workers work shift work.
And the guys that would get off at 8 o'clock in the morning would come running like hell in there at 10 minutes after 8. See, they're in there. And to them, this is the middle of the day. You got to remember, these guys were not drinking early in the morning. This was like, you know, a guy stopping by for a martini at the 517 on his way to Wilton, right? So they would come roaring in there, and these guys did this. They drink only one thing, a shot and a beer. It's all said in one word, shot and a beer. See, or once in a while, if a guy is really esoteric, he would say, hey, Al, give me a Boilermaker. Okay, so Boilermaker, a shot and a beer. And he would have about 10 of them lined up back at the bar already. So he'd buy whiskey, and he would have get up the glasses lined up for the beer. And the minute these guys would come roaring in, he's ready, see. But the one thing you got to know about this, this was a Polish bar. Okay. So there was a little slight variation. Now, there was an Italian bar down the street. They had different stuff. There was a Hungarian bar down the street. It was different, too. But the Polish bar had one thing on it. In the back, by the cash register, back of the bar, had this great big pitcher. It was like a great big glass jar is what it was. Have you ever seen those glass jars that are shaped like a barrel? Fake barrel, like a big top on it, see? With sort of cloudy liquid in it? Well, this thing had... just had this stuff floating in. Great. Every morning I'd see him in there. And once in a while he would be taking things out of this thing and putting them into the icebox in the back. And his smell, fantastic smell. Oh, boy. What a terrific smell. Now, most of the bars around here, when you come in at 8 o'clock in the morning, they smell like old used beer. You know what I'm talking about? Old used beer and disinfectant. Disinfectant is from the place. You know, bars tend to have cute names on the jars, you know, like his or hers, you know, the stags and the cows and that kind of stuff, see. So, he'd smell the bar, smell the, boy, this one was different. He'd smell it, fantastic smell. And he'd have that big jar. Sometimes it would be filled right to the top, sometimes it would be filled halfway. And every morning he's behind the bar when I would come in. He's mopping up. And one morning, I come in there, see, and I used to sneak him on all the time. When he didn't even offer me any pretzels, I would reach out and grab a handful of pretzels, see, when he's not looking. I'd throw the paper down. Yeah, you know, he knew. And I'd get back on the bike and go. I look forward to that thing every morning, going into the Bluebird and grabbing some pretzels or some potato chips or some popcorn and, you know, getting on out. But that was that popcorn. You look forward to this thing. Well, on this particular morning, which I shall never forget, which gives me, let's say, a feeling of more than average empathy for Pepito. Understand what Pepito did, how he felt, and why he went berserk. Now, if he had a machine gun, he probably would have blasted the whole neighborhood, right? So I came into the tavern this morning. It was in the Bluebird Street. I come whistling in, and the bartender is not behind the bar this morning. And I can hear some banging around going way back in the back of the bar. It was one of these long, narrow buildings, like, you know, in the back. There was a kind of a dark place in the back, and they had a couple of pool tables back there, and a jukebox, and a telephone in the back. You know, it's, you know, a few tables sitting back there. And he's in the back there doing something, and I can hear him banging around with cases of stuff and bottles rattling. So I hollered out of house, "Paper boy!" And he says, "Okay, yeah, put it on the bar, it's all right." The first time I had ever been in there, and he wasn't around. He was in the back there. They had like a storage room back there where they kept empties and stuff. That's where he was. When I saw my chance, it was this great big jar, fantastic jar, full of this cloudy liquid with these green and red things floating in. Well, now, they really looked good. And I had many times, we had gone to this Italian restaurant, and they had these pimentos. You know what those pimentos are like? They're really great. You know those roasted sweet pimentos? And that's what they looked like. They were sort of red and floating in there. They had this fantastic smell. And there were spices floating in there with them, and slices of onion floating in this cloudy, milky liquid. So he's in the back, and I holler down, "Okay!" And he says, "Hey, Joe, you want some popcorn? Grab all you want!" I said, "Okay!" So I reaches over the bar,
And I quickly unscrews the top of the thing. I take the top. Oh, what a smell. Fantastic. I reach into the jar. See, all the way up to my wrist. Sort of a cloudy, milky liquid. And I grab a handful of this stuff, whip it on, it's dripping all over the place. I put the top back on, and I quickly take the bottle rag, which is when I quickly wipe off the juice, run back out, get on my bike, and I start rolling down the street. And I got a handful of this stuff. Oh, smell, see? Well, now, I had always done it this way. I would get on my bike. This is where your M.O. will kill you sometimes, friends. My M.O. prior to that moment had always been, I would get on my bike, I would start going, steering it with one hand, and then I'd make about five big pedals, get the bike rolling good, and now I'm going on past the A&P, and I would just open my mouth, and, in would go the popcorn, or in would go the pretzel, the mouth. See? So I get down there by the A&P, and I go, like that. For one brief instant, I sat there for a second. I could smell the spices. I could taste them. And then all of a sudden... I can't breathe. It's going all the way down into my feet. My eyeballs are busted. It's like I've taken a gigantic... full quart slug of pure electricity. Have you ever wondered what electricity tastes like? I took my bike wobbling, and down I went. Oh my God. I would say 15 minutes. My entire head felt like it was asleep. You ever had your foot fall asleep? You know that tingling? You couldn't feel anything. My head was asleep. My throat burnt all the way down into my gut. And I had one desire, only one. Was to get a drink of water. And I went down the street, and I go into the Shell station, and they had this nozzle, and I turn the nozzle on, and I take a great big gulp of cold water, and then, a big gulp of cold water, and, oh my God! It starts again! It's even worse! I learned one secret of Polish peppers. Don't ever drink cold water after you've eaten a Polish pepper. It comes on twice as hard. And it was at that moment that I formed a lifelong respect for the Polish. I would see these Polish steel workers drinking beer and eating those peppers, popping them in like you would eat peanuts. Just like that. I'll tell you, the Poles are strong people. I would never cross anything with them. Anybody who can eat peppers like that is a mighty man. And it wasn't until maybe 3 or 4 o'clock that afternoon that my taste began to return. I could quickly taste things. And for at least 3 days after that, every time I would drink a glass of milk or water or Coke or anything, I was burning. And I could hear the flames of hell snapping and crackling down there deep in my gut. Oh, what a smell. But any time you go into a Polish bar and you see that big jar back of that bar there next to the cash register, you see those Polish beer drinkers knocking down the Boilermakers, popping those peppers, you know that you're in the presence of true strength, true power, man. Power. So that concludes tonight's salute to Pepito, the poor little monkey that ate the sandwich with the peppers. And that's just how you feel, Pepito. Had there been a zoo around, I think I'd been put into a cage that night. I was ready to kill. Thank you.
This is WOR New York. You stay tuned for In Conversation, okay?